and trying to look at what's happened in the market. And then the next time they go to the meeting, say, hey, when that stock did that, what did you do? So not so worried about what the stock was and what they think of it, but how's a manager going to respond?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Investing City podcast, where the goal is to get better at investing, business, and life. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us. It really means a lot. Without further ado, enjoy this episode. The following is presented for informational purposes only and is not investment advice. This information must not be relied upon in making any investment decision. Investing City cannot be held responsible for any type of loss incurred by applying any of the information presented. Furthermore, securities discussed in this podcast may be held by Investing City and members thereof. Thank you. On today's episode of the Investing City podcast, we speak with Ted Seides. So Ted is the host of the Capital Allocators podcast, one of the top investing podcasts, and he started his career under David Swensen, the man who manages Yale's endowment, one of the best performing endowment funds of all time. So in this conversation, we talk a bunch about how Ted thinks about selecting different hedge fund managers and his own investment process. So please enjoy this one with Ted Seides. Okay, on today's episode of the Investing City podcast, super excited to have Ted Seides on. So thanks so much for being here, Ted.
Oh, my pleasure, Ryan. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So why don't we just dive a little bit into your background? I think you have a really interesting background, so I think it'd be awesome for to just kind of fill listeners in.
Yeah, I started in this business right out of college. And I guess you'd call this business allocating money to managers. It wasn't necessarily much of a business back then, but that was back in 1992. And my first job right out of college was working for Dave Swensen at the Yale Endowment. And the endowment back then was $2.5 billion on its way to six when I left 5 years later to go to business school. And I really learned pretty much everything I came to learn about investing in that style from David in those 5 years, just an incredible experience to sit at the feet of, you know, who became known as probably the greatest in the business. And I thought I wanted to pick stocks. So I went to business school to learn a little bit more about business fundamentals as opposed to manager fundamentals, if you call it that. And tried my hand at that over a summer job and a little bit afterwards, and was finding that it wasn't as exciting to me, or it wasn't my thing in the way that I really enjoyed the people side of investing in managers. So I decided to go back to that and formed a partnership that became a hedge fund of funds called Protégé Partners. We launched the fund in 2002, and it was investing in early stage hedge funds and seeding new hedge funds. And that business caught a tidal wave of capital that was coming from then up until the financial crisis. So we did quite well. And I stayed until 2015. A couple other things happened along the way. I made this little bet with Warren Buffett that people know about. And when I left, I wasn't sure what I would do. So I had a bunch of projects working with different pools of capital. And alongside of that, decided to run around and talk to some of my old friends about what they were doing and share the recordings. And as a pursuit of productive time, I wouldn't say, never thought it would be a business, or certainly didn't think it would be the core focus of what I was doing. It became that over a couple of years. And so now I have this podcast called Capital Allocators, and wrote a book that came out recently called Capital Allocators, and do a whole bunch of work with some money managers as well to keep me engaged in the investing side of the business, and I invest my own capital. So it's been an interesting ride, a couple of different steps along the way.
That's awesome. So, I mean, it's just amazing having kind of the background at Yale with David Swensen. I mean, for listeners that don't know, he's basically like the Buffett of endowments, like just all time. So I'd love for you to share just a few key lessons that you really took away from your time under him.
Yeah, it was amazing, especially in retrospect, to see the benefit of having learned from someone who really is exceptional and does things a right way. There are a lot of right ways, but a right way. Before I learned my own bad habits, I used to tell people I learned what a hedge fund was and what a stock was on the same day. So the fundamentals were the same. David has a terrific way of framing and thinking about the investment challenge. And I was able to learn that in kind of a deep way. So that starts with understanding what you're trying to do. A lot of people don't think about it that way. They just like stocks, or they like this. You know, what are you trying to do? What's the pool of capital serving? And what's the best way to go about doing that? Within the type of capital he manages, which is extremely long duration and endowment, he looked at it and said, well, because you're trying to invest for a long period of time and your liabilities are actually quite low on a year-to-year basis, you want to invest with an equity orientation. And to do that, there are lots of different ways. Back then, it was sort of a 60-40, 70-30 type stock bond portfolio. And he said, that doesn't make much sense. You only have two assets, and diversification is the only free lunch if you do it the right way. So he sought to diversify the equity exposure, and that became known as investing in less liquid things. But of course, if you're investing in US stocks, that is the most liquid equity-oriented thing you could do. So everything else will be less liquid. So I learned a couple things. I learned how you sort of think about the investment problem in any situation. And particularly the implementation was manager selection. So the whole process of how do you go about sourcing great managers, the types of due diligence you do, how you go about making those decisions, how you build a network that creates its own flywheel to find those good managers over time, was everything I learned in those 5 years.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would love to dig in a little bit just about that process. Earlier, you mentioned the term manager fundamentals, which I think is a term that, you know, like classic stock pickers may not have heard as much. So I would love for you to just dive in and tell us a little bit kind of about that process from a little bit from start to finish, like even the sourcing to what exactly you're looking for.
Sure. So picking a manager has a lot of parallels with picking a stock, but they are quite different, because the inputs are different and the outputs to some extent are similar. So what you start with sourcing managers, and not, again, terribly dissimilar from the way you'd source stocks. If you meet with lots of managers, at the very beginning of that process, everyone you meet, you'll think is really, really good. You meet five, you'll think, wow, these five are great. You might even say, hey, I really like those three better than those two, or maybe four better than those one. When you meet with a couple hundred or a couple thousand, you start to detect differences, subtle differences. And what you start to realize is, what is quite unfortunate to the community at large, is that a very, very small subset of that are truly exceptional over the masses. And you also can sort of figure out the types of qualities that go into a manager that are more likely to succeed than others. And a lot of those are structural. Some of them have to do with the person, but a lot of it has to do with what type of capital is behind them. What's the duration of the opportunity that they're trying to pursue? How much do they understand why that they are likely to add value, and how much of that has long tails to it, and how much of it is just a shorter term thing? And so there are a lot of structural things that kind of help you figure out where you want to be on that spectrum. And that all goes into that initial sourcing. The due diligence process really is a lot of face-to-face meetings. And in the book I just put out, I talk about interviewing. Like, clearly you're interviewing me. I interview people on my podcast, but I spent 20 years interviewing money managers without having thought a lot about what is that process that you're actually doing in the interview. So I wrote about some of that in the book. But you do spend a lot of time with money managers, talking to them about who they are, how they think, and what they do. And it's both them and their organization and all the aspects of that. And that's in a room or in a meeting setting. There's then a lot of work that goes behind that, where you could hear something that you think is attractive for your portfolio, but you need to verify it. So there's a lot of different ways of verifying it. And now there's more data than there used to be. So you could imagine an allocator verifying it by taking great notes and then looking at the types of the stocks that that manager was talking about for a stock picking fund and trying to look at what's happened in the market. And then the next time they go to the meeting, say, hey, when that stock did that, what did you do? So not so worried about what the stock was and what they think of it, but how's a manager going to respond? And then you have a whole set of reference checking that goes into that process, which is that verification of what did you see and what did you do? So you'll come through that and you'll say most of the time, okay, maybe we like them, we want to follow them, maybe for a long time, maybe we're really interested. But there's a whole other side of it, which is where does it fit into someone's portfolio? So you're walking in to talk to an allocator. They have an existing portfolio of managers. Presumably those are their best ideas at any point in time. How do you fit into that portfolio? How do you you know, remove someone, displace someone from that portfolio. And then once you've been in front of this allocator and you've won their favor, they report to somebody else most of the time. They don't own, David Swensen doesn't own Yale's capital, Yale does. So he has an investment committee and he and his team have to bring that idea to a committee. And then there's a process that's completely opaque from a manager of whether or not that idea gets approved. And a manager will never know what happens in that process, but that's fine. And so that's sort of, and then once a manager is in a portfolio, there's a continuous monitoring process of, you know, how is that allocator thinking about the future potential returns of that manager and the place of that manager in their portfolio. So a lot of those things parallel how a stock might fit into a manager's portfolio, but the inputs are different, right? It's much more qualitative. There's not as much data. Most of the data is performance, and most good allocators understand that you can ask good questions off of someone's past performance, but you can't rely on the past performance for the future, obviously. And so, you know, there are aspects of it that are quantitative, but most of it's a very qualitative assessment.
That's super interesting. Thanks for going into detail. So you also mentioned the process of interviewing, which I think is interesting as you've done hundreds and thousands of interviews. So talk a little bit about that. Like, do you have any favorite questions for ferreting out interesting things for managers, or like anything that you found really helpful?
I don't think there are silver bullets at all. So there's no one question that if I just know the answer to this, there are certain topics that are important for allocators to understand. So obviously you're going to walk through lots and lots of different types of questions that go into the investment process and the team. From an allocator's perspective, some of the things that are most important have to do with the character of the people, the alignment. You'll hear alignment of interests a lot. David really preached that strongly, and lots of allocators do. How do I know when I go back to my office that our interests are aligned? And some of that's compensation, some of that's motivation, but there's a lot of different questions about alignment of interest. And then there's just judgment, right? There's this question of how do I assess your judgment? Like, Ryan, how do I know that you're going to be great at what you do? And that's something that usually that assessment, it's certainly imprecise, but certainly takes time. You can't have one meeting with someone and have a sense of what you think of their judgment. In the book, so within that, there are lots and lots of great questions that people ask. I like to say most of those questions start with how, what, or why. They are brief, open-ended questions. And I did put in a bunch of those questions across those topics that some of my guests on the show and other very talented CIOs are some of their favorite questions to ask. And so, yes, you can word questions in a certain way, but some of the best questions are simple. Like, I could ask a manager, what do you do with your money that's not in their fund? That reveals all kinds of things. One is, you know, how are they going to respond to that? Is there, no, all my money is in my fund. Okay. Is it really? Why is it? Is it that are our risks aligned? Forget about our interests being aligned. And if they start talking about what they do with their other money, oh, that might be a source of other interesting investment ideas. How broadly do they think about the investing world and not just their strategy? There's all kinds of things that come out of just a simple question like that.
That's super interesting. I'm kind of curious, what would be an answer that would really like pique your interest on that? Like showing that they have a broad interest of things, or because, I mean, like, what are your thoughts on the manager having all their capital invested? Maybe that means that they can't actually take on more risk. Yeah, I'm just curious.
So the worst thing I could do is tell you, oh, I know what that answer should be.
Right.
Because everything is situational. It's very important that managers are aligned with their clients. And so you can imagine Andy Golden at Princeton likes to use this. We always used to talk about alignment of interests. He talks about alignment of risks. So to your point, depending on the risk of the strategy, I may want the manager to have all their money in it because it's perfect alignment. Or I look back at my old years. I used to have a lot of my capital invested alongside my partners at Protégé Partners. And it was a terrible use for my capital as a young guy. I wanted to take more risk than what we were taking for the clients, but you do it as a signaling effect. So in every situation, the amount of capital might vary of what's optimal. But if somebody could tell you lots of different things in that answer, they could describe to you a thought process that you say, wow, like they're really thoughtful. They see around corners. That's what I want in my manager. Somebody else might say, I only want that manager and that strategy so focused on this one thing because they have to be to succeed. I don't want them thinking about anything else. And so if they're thinking about all these other investments, maybe they're thinking too much about other things. So there's no one answer that gives you that silver bullet. But when you're through this in every situation, you might say, this feels good or this doesn't feel good. And then you could articulate why in both cases.
Yeah, really interesting. So I know you also do some consulting for like hedge funds to help them either grow or, so I would just be curious, like if you had to start a fund knowing what you know on the other side with the allocator's perspective, like what are some things that you would do that would kind of help you grow your network or kind of grow the fund?
Boy, lots of interesting different questions. I think by the time you're launching a fund, if you were at that point in time looking to grow your network, you're probably in trouble. So if people have the idea that they want to grow a fund over time, you know, there's two aspects of that. One, which a lot of managers do, which is they focus on how to invest. And the other is, which they don't, which is how do you grow a business? And in this space, growing a business means there's capital. So there are a lot more good ideas than there are capital to back them. So, you know, I have my own thoughts about that. In fact, it is something I'm thinking of doing again in the future. And part of that for me is what I found worked really well when we started Project, which was, you know, two things. One, having really long duration capital. And two, being very, very flexible in what that opportunity set is. And so in 2002, I would describe that as a hedge fund. Today, I would not describe that as a hedge fund for lots of different reasons, but there are other things that have both of those features. And so, yeah, I'm thinking about it because I'm mostly running out of putting my capital to work in the things I think are interesting. And so I'm, you know, I may at some point, you know, have some friends alongside me, not quite the same as I did it the first time around.
Gotcha. Super interesting. So like, what's an example of something that has that flexibility nowadays? Like, what are some potential ideas you're thinking through?
Well, part of it is structural, which is sort of, you could think about what type of structure would you want for a fund. So for me, I mostly invest in managers. I don't want to invest in a certain box. So I don't want to be a hedge fund to fund manager. I don't want to be a private equity fund to fund manager. So what I've done with some of my own capital, you know, I've invested in some private equity funds. I've invested in late stage privates that are co-invests. I've invested directly in the markets. I want the flexibility to do all of that, you know, as one example. So you could imagine something like the crypto space. I just own Bitcoin and Ethereum right now. But if I really wanted to dive in deeply, I probably want to hire a manager to do that. Now, do I want to work with like Chris Dixon and Andreessen? Yeah, probably. What about Ari Paul, Block Tower? Maybe, like that's a trading strategy. It's a very different perspective. So if I want to put my capital to work, I probably want to do a little bit of the best of all of that, but I don't want to be forced to do just one because that's the box I'm living in.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. So I'm also curious because you're at a position where you're able to see so many different strategies and you've had all this experience. Like, how do you even think about allocating your own money in terms of speaking to that flexibility, like private equity, there's all these asset classes. How do you think about diversifying your own money?
Yeah. So the nice thing is if it's your own money, you really can, you know, people, a lot of times people ask a manager, how would you invest your own money? If it's not this, well, it's like your own money. So, you know, I would go back to where we started, which is I have to think about what's the purpose for me of managing that capital, right? Some of it is to fund different parts of my life, so I need some liquidity. Mm-hmm. Some of it is I don't think I'm going to touch this money for a long time. I can have really, really long duration. And so I don't structure it in asset classes the way I did in early in my career. And part of that is because there are some benefits to that that I know accrue to a portfolio. But I don't think we're in the environment where that's the best strategy. And because I don't have to answer to anyone else, I can just do it. So I would describe it as very opportunistic with certain underlying aspects of it. So it's very equity oriented. And if I don't have something better to do, I'll just own an index fund. I don't own a lot of index funds. I usually have better things to do. So where am I funding that, you know, and am I diversified? Sure. I'm generally diversified somewhat geographically, there's some mix of public and private markets, but I mostly have a pool of capital that I think is compounding. And the way I describe it is totally different from how I did as an institutional investor. So I describe it as compounding relationships. I'm not really interested in investing something that's transactional to me, that I'm going to give someone money and they're going to make a bunch of money for me. But I look for situations where I can add value to them. And it's going to be a long-term relationship. And through that, what I found is the compounds capital. The capital is compounding a lot faster than it did when I was trying to focus on how do I compound capital faster. Mm-hmm. And that's just a perfect for me. It's an alignment of who I am with what the strategy is.
That's really interesting. Just like the thought of what can I do for this person is like kind of like give and you'll receive. Really cool. So I want to talk a little bit about like the diligence process from start to finish. If you find a manager that you'd be interested in, what's the typical diligence process? Is it super varied in terms of timeline based on maybe how long you've known this person, but like what's sort of typical?
Yeah. Well, it's quite different today in an institutional seat than it, I'm sorry, today as myself, just investing my own capital, than it was an institutional seat. So I'm not sure which are you interested in how do CIOs do it with their pools of capital or how am I doing it with my own capital?
Maybe both. Like talk about when you were at Yale and doing Protégé versus now.
Yeah. So Yale Protégé was similar. It's a very long process. You get to know people over time. You do all of those steps of the work that we talked about earlier. And in some situations, it takes years. In other situations, if there's an underlying market opportunity that needs to be addressed, it might happen a lot quicker. So that varies quite a bit, but most of the time it takes time. On my own is totally different, right? I'm very focused on the people. I'm using my instincts to determine the underlying opportunity set. And I do, a fraction of the due diligence that I used to do to confirm what's there, because I'm putting a lot more weight into the people relationships and trust. And if something goes wrong, it's just on me. I'm not a fiduciary to anybody else. So, if I go raise capital from other people, I'll bring people on my team who can make sure that, like, I certainly know how to do that work and it's important. But those are risks, given that I'm investing with people I know, like those are risks I'm willing to take on myself. So it's a much quicker process for me individually.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So I'd like to shift gears a little bit and talk about your book and kind of the podcast. So talk a little bit about those initial interviews, like what led you to actually start the podcast, and then we'll kind of go from there.
Yeah. So the podcast, as I mentioned, just came out of me having a little extra time on my hands, and it just went from there, and I just kept going, and I've been fortunate to know a lot of great people in the business, and so probably the first 50 episodes, I say something like 45 of them were people I knew, and they're great people, and they have great stories to tell, so that was the podcast. Yeah, and I forgot the first part of the question you had asked.
Oh, no. I think that's interesting. And then talk a little bit kind of about the book. Is there a section in the book that is like your favorite?
So the book came out of the podcast, and it came out of me wanting to distill the lessons for myself. I had written a book about hedge funds when I left Protégé, and that was for other people. It was sort of, I've learned all this stuff. I don't really want to do it anymore. Let me share these lessons. This was totally different. This was, I actually want to take what I've learned and have it on my desk for when I'm investing for myself. So there's three sections of the book. The first are frameworks, which are, I call it a toolkit. They're all the skills that a CIO needs that aren't taught in the investment world. Decision-making theory from interviewing Annie Duke and Michael Mauboussin is probably the most prominent. And then there's a chapter on interviewing, which is really comes out of my own experience from the last couple of years that are fun. The second section is a bunch of the stuff we've been talking about, the whole investment process, how CIOs are thinking about different investment frameworks and how they go about doing what they do. And the last, which is probably my favorite, are called Nuggets of Wisdom, which are 161 quotes of the best quotes of people on the show, distilled into investment lessons and life lessons, but that don't quite fit into one of those other sections of the book. And then there's a top 10 list at the end, which is my sense of what the 10 very best quotes from something like 3,500 pages of transcripts are.
Wow. Yeah, that's a lot of work going through everything. So, I'm curious, do you have a a few interviews that you've done on the podcast that sort of stick out? I know it's hard to, it's kind of like picking a favorite child, but just some things that kind of jump out.
Yeah, I mean, there are some more than others. It's very, as you mentioned, it's very, very hard. I've done now over 200 of them, so it's hard to pick out. But in each category, sometimes the early ones are some of the ones that stick out the most. So when I interviewed Scott Malpass, who's the recently retired CIO at Notre Dame, that interview was almost exactly what I had hoped I would do on the show, which was like a 30-year evolution of how you manage one of these pools of capital. And I'd say similar for Andy Golden, who I'd worked with at Yale, who's managed Princeton's endowment for a long time. So some of those early ones were great. The most listened to so far, I interviewed Chamath Palihapitiya earlier this year, and everybody loves hearing from Chamath. He's doing a new seed business. We talked about that. And then there's a guy named Michael Schwimmer, who's a former minor league, or sort of former major league baseball pitcher, who had worked his way through the minor leagues and created a fund called Big League Advance that's it was a private equity fund, or is a private equity fund, doing income sharing agreements with minor league players. And there's a fascinating backstory that he tells about his own life and data analytics and what he's done with this fund. And I know it's been wildly successful. So that, you know, I prefer to say I may have my own favorites, but those are some of the ones that were other people's favorites.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I actually haven't listened to that one. So that sounds fascinating. I noticed that as listening to your podcast, you have a few questions that you like to ask. And one is like, are there any lessons from your parents that have really made an impact on you? So I'd like to kind of throw that back to you.
So there are. I mean, I think the most important one from my parents was unconditional love. And this lesson got hit home in a way that I hadn't really even appreciated earlier this year, sort of over the last year. So a couple of years ago, my father's in his late 80s, and we'd almost lost my father just to normal kind of medical issues. And in the process, for the first time, because he kept it to himself, we had a sense of what the family finances are. And what I would tell you is my brother, I have an older brother, younger sister, and I, we all went to college and we all went to graduate school without any debt. And then you look at what my parents have left today, and you know, they're okay, but they can't today afford some of the simpler luxuries you would want, even say luxuries, some of the almost necessities you would want being older and healthcare and stuff like that. So the fact that they gave that to us at their own expense was a whole nother level. I felt that unconditional love when I was growing up, but the thought that you would sacrifice everything just to put your kids in a better place than you felt like you were was just unbelievable. And, you know, something that I certainly learned from them.
Wow. Well, I think that's an amazing place to wrap up, but I really appreciate your time, Ted. And thanks so much for doing this.
Yeah, my pleasure, Ryan. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to the Investing City podcast. It really means the world to us. And before you go, we have a proposition. So please leave a review on iTunes. It just would help us out so much. And if you do so, just email us. I left a review and we'll give you a gift. That's right. We'll give you a gift if you leave a review. Thank you so much. We really appreciate you.